Thank you for joining us for live paranormal radio. From the paranormal to the unexplained, it all happens here.
It all happens here.
Looking to enhance your radio experience? Participate in our live video chat 24/7 with our live paranormal radio show hosts and other like-minded people. Live. Paranormal.com, the only interactive social chat room supported by Full Interaction Media. Stop by now and join the fun.
Stop by now and join the fun.
It's Haunted Playground, right here on the Live Paranormal Radio Network. I'm your host, Sheena Metal. I'm a psychic medium. I'm an interfaith minister. I'm a 26-year talk radio host. And I'm proud to be here at my new radio hub, liveparanormal.com. We are syndicated around the world, many wonderful places, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, iTunes, Podbean, you name it. You will find us, and you'll find me here every Wednesday at 6 o'clock Pacific time. I'm at SheenaMetalSpiritual.com. The show's at HauntedPlayground.com. And, of course, liveparanormal.com is where you can find the station. I also do my Raising the Vibration show every Tuesday at 5 o'clock Pacific time here on the Live Paranormal Radio Network. And I do three shows on the Live Paranormal Video Network on Tuesday, Wednesdays, and Fridays at 9 o'clock Pacific time. And that is at facebook.com/TheLiveParanormal. Check out all my shows. A new one is coming. Probably another one is coming after that. I can't seem to get enough. Here on Haunted Playground, we talk about all things spiritual, paranormal, and entertainment. I gather some of my favorite people, I think sort of the best and the brightest minds, hearts, and souls I know. And we discuss everything, including things that go bump in the night. And as a kid, I was obsessed with all things paranormal, as I think many kids that wind up here in the paranormal community are. And when I was a kid, there wasn't a whole lot of stuff that you could see on television that was outside of the three dimensions. But one of those things was a fantastic, wonderful classic TV show called The Munsters. And my guest today, of course, was the littlest Munster, Eddie. And he's such a great guy, and I love having him here and hearing his story and talking to him about everything exciting thing that he is doing all over the world, sort of bringing joy to people, talking about being on that show and growing up in the entertainment business and his journey. And it's great to have him here for the first time at liveparanormal.com. Please welcome my wonderful guest and wonderful friend and fantastic being that you are going to love, the very, very amazing Butch Patrick is here today. How are you, my friend? It's so wonderful to be here and to hear your voice again, and I'm glad you have survived and you are okay.
Thank you. Thank you very much. What a wonderful intro.
My pleasure, sweetie. I love having you. I have to say that kind of every time now that I do a show is, I'm so glad you're here. It's been a strange year, right? So, and probably really strange for you because, you know, you spend a lot of your life on the road, right?
I do. As a matter of fact, right now, the last 2 days, I drove, I drove from L.A. to Boulder City and stopped, and I went from Boulder City to Albuquerque and stopped, and now I'm in outside of Oklahoma, outside of Tulsa, in a beautiful resort called Shangri-La on Monkey Island. So, yes, I am traveling, and then tomorrow I'll be on the road again, and then Sunday I'll be in Cincinnati. So, yes, travel is my name.
Wow, and are you still traveling despite the quarantine? I mean, obviously, it must have slowed up for you at some point.
Well, what happened was I flew out to visit my sister from Florida in March, obviously last year, on the 13th. And on the 16th, the state went into full lockdown. So I was sort of stranded out there. I had left my truck in Raleigh where I flew in from, and I had left my trailer and my Munster coach and my Munster cars in Atlanta at a friend's haunted attraction. So I literally was stuck out there for, I think I didn't do anything until June. And then in June, I flew to Cleveland and did a pilot, and then I flew over to Raleigh where I picked up my coach and then my truck, and then I picked up my trailer, and I actually drove for 17 days. I was crisscrossing the country doing a lot of appearances, you know, social distancing and, you know, maintaining this and maintaining that. But I probably was one of the few people that was actually hit 17 states in 14 days and drove all the way out to the West Coast.
I agree, because I think most people shut down and pretty much shut down, and that was the end of the story at the time. And
yeah.
pretty much stopped
yeah,
everything. I just switched everything virtually. So I've been working my butt off, but from my bedroom. It's kind of a whole different world now for me. But I admire that you're out there seeing people.
I was lucky that I was in a place where I was comfortable. My sister lives in a beautiful place in Manhattan Beach, so I had a very nice place to hang out. Her dog likes me, which is a must.
Very important. Right. If the dog doesn't like you, you're done.
That's right. I know. That's true. So it was, for me, it was lucky that someone had a pilot in Cleveland to do. And then I did that and got back to California. And then I flew back to Wisconsin for July 4th weekend. Somebody had an outdoor festival up there, a car show, which went well. And so in and out of this horrible 2020 year for everybody, I was very blessed that I was actually able to get through it and healthy and actually continue to do a few things. And what I did is I kind of had the mindset that if you follow the rules and you're smart and use common sense, you can survive. But it's, I have a lot of respect for people that stayed indoors, and that's okay too.
Yeah, absolutely. And realize that people are a lot of people are in a place of trauma right now, either from losing people or just from the terrible fear of disease that I think as human beings is innate in us, right? We have this innate will to survive, and, and pandemics kind of put a hitch in that get along. People are a little different right now and just kind of ebb and flow with that. And I think that's okay. It just is what mm-hmm. it is. And find a way to create an environment for people where people can still feel like they're involved in things. And if it needs to be online, or if it needs to be social distance, or it needs to be outdoors, the most important thing is that we keep engaging, right? Because you must see from you do the horror cons, right? And you do the paracons and with the Munster Mobiles, and you do the classic TV conventions. And I mean, there's a lot of people, right, that are, and I talked about this yesterday. Our dear mutual friend, Johnny Whitaker, was my guest on Raising the Vibration. Yep. And we talked about how, like, one of the biggest enemies of people, I think humanity, I think even worse than COVID, is loneliness. Like, people are lonely. And sometimes people that come out to these conventions, they can be from really small places where they don't see a whole lot of people in their day. And they kind of live vicariously through their TV and their DVD collection and the internet. And they come out to see all you at conventions and see the thing that they love. And that makes their whole life, right? So for them not to have that for a year, that could be tough.
One of the things that I'm actually moving, it's funny, 2 hours ago I looked at this theater outside of this area where I'm at, and it's one of the 22 organ theaters left in the country, and it's got the big Wurlitzer organ, and the inside is from a 30s and 40s restored situation. The movie houses of the golden age of movie premieres. So I went and looked at it, because what I'm doing this year is what I've designed is an evening out, because what I miss most is going to the movies, and I think a lot of people feel the same way. So what I've done is I was doing a show like yours, and a magician named David Merlin heard me, and he contacted me, and he goes, I got an idea. We should get together and work together. And what we're doing now is we're doing a old school Hollywood premiere look to the reopening of movie theaters with a screening of Munster Go Home, the new Blu-ray version that I did with Rob Zombie. We did commentary in December of 19, but it never got a chance to see the light of day because of COVID. So we're going out, and we're going to do an evening where I introduce the movie, and it's 90 minutes long, and then I do a meet and greet, and I do an intro, and then I introduce David Merlin to do his magic show, his illusion show, after the movie, of which we have two Munster illusions written in to his show. And the idea is that people come out social distance, be safe, but see a movie, see some magic, and help theater owners reopen. And I'm very excited about the idea, because it's doing it for the right reasons, to help the community, to help small businesses, and to help people, get over this terrible year.
Yeah, I think that's wonderful. And we need that kind of thing again. We need to congregate, and people need to go out and remember things that they loved and remember a time before this.
Yep.
So that once this is over, and it looks like with all the vaccinating, we're getting close, right? Once this is over, we're not so PTSD from it that we still refuse to go out. I just want to make sure that people recover.
Well, I like to, I'm kind of I always try to look at things half full as opposed to half empty. You know, I'm pretty much a positive person, and I'm deep in that gratitude, and, I got over 10 years of sobriety now, so I got a pretty good grasp and a handle on how to take things and make the most of them of a positive nature. And I see this as a win-win-win because I'm working with the theater owner to open up. I'm not asking him for money. We're going to sell tickets together, and we're going to create this for the community, and we're going to help people, and then we'll be on to the next stop and the next stop. And in between, we do things as well. I'm doing a thing with a firehouse to help them do a fundraiser because they were volunteer for the whole year, and their war chest is empty. So we're going to do something with them. And I love helping work with people to, each individual case is a different situation. But if we put our heads together and we figure out how to do it, it works well for all concerned. And bottom line, the community benefits from it.
I agree 100%. That's so true, and the community absolutely benefits from it. And also, it's community is such an important thing, and we can't forget about the word community and the word unity, because I think those are such very, very important things. And also, people who love classic horror, they like being scared, right? That's why they liked it. Well, but they don't like being scared in their real life. Like I always say, in my work as a medium and a psychic, like, I love your ghosts, but I don't want them in my house. Like, I love to go to other people's haunted places, but I don't want anything in my house. And so I think that this has maybe hit a little too close to home, even for people who binge The Walking Dead. And now it's time for people to get into a place where we replace fear with joy again.
Okay, yeah.
Because joy is important. We can't forget how important it is to feel joy, and people feel that when they meet you, right? They get to relive their childhood. And my mom said that to me once.
Yeah, well, one of the most commonly asked questions is people, first of all, they think the show was on forever when it was only on for 2 years. And they go, I can't believe it was only on for 2 years. It's been 55 years, and I feel like it had to be on 5 years. And I explained to them that we did a lot of episodes, and there was only 3 channels, and there was no internet, and kids came home when the lights came on, and it was a different world. So it has a big footprint in society because society was so different back then. The reason it's still popular, family values are family values, and they've always been strong. But in this particular scenario in the last few years, even more so than ever, do people like the idea of being able to be transported back to a simpler time and warm memories with grandparents and aunts and uncles hovered around the TV set and looking at the TV guide trying to figure out what they're going to be watching. So it was something that kids that, unfortunately, that weren't old enough to remember probably never will have that joy. But the next best thing is to watch it, reruns and syndication and old Antenna TV and MeTV and Cozy TV and all these channels that specialize in old shows are very popular.
I agree 100%. I think that's very true. And also I think that there was, and we've talked about this when you've done my show before, and I was thinking about you saying you've been sober for over 10 years. I remember you doing my show and talking about how you had just gotten sober. So that's how long we've known each other, like longer than you've been sober. That's crazy.
I remember when I did your show, I was outside in Cleveland. I remember that very much because I was doing it by the river.
Yes.
And I only had I was in my first year or year and a half of sobriety.
Beautiful. Congratulations, my friend. That's such a beautiful thing.
It's
harder to live sober, but it's a beautiful thing.
Well, as I was listening to your opening I had forgotten how deeply you were into paranormal stuff.
Yeah, I grew up in a horrible haunted house. I mean, a really active, negative haunted house when I lived on the East Coast. And, that kind of stuff sticks with you, that stuff. Now, do I remember correctly, and then we'll get back and talk about the monsters a bit more, didn't you move to a house that was haunted that, like, somebody in your family had grown up in and you bought or you lived there for a while as a kid? Are you still there?
Yeah, when I finished doing the Munsters, my grandmother had moved from a little place in Illinois where I left to a big house that was built in 1875 in a little town called Macon, Missouri, which at the time I didn't know was haunted, although my younger sister had a definite relationship going with Miss Ruby, who was Elizabeth Wardell, and she was the resident gatekeeper of the ghost. And what happened was is I always kept an eye on the house when I became an adult because, you know, you're 13 in the eighth grade and you have childhood friends, and I loved it. I loved the town. I loved the house. And I found out that it was going to be demolished about 7 years ago. So what I did is I reached out to the realtor, and we came up. Anyway, I wound up buying the house, yes. And when I moved into it, my sister says, and say hi to Miss Ruby. And I go, who in the heck's Miss Ruby? She goes, that's the ghost. She goes, you didn't know Grandma's house was haunted? And I said, I don't really recall it. I go, she goes, don't you remember Grandma wouldn't let us go in the basement and this and that? And I said, no. And she goes, well, it is. And so I bought the house. And sure enough, when we moved into it, it was although I never physically saw anything, we had lots of stuff on cameras, the town folk, people who had been living there before. Everybody pretty much knew that this was the haunted house in the area, and it happened to be built. It was built on a vortex. So I had a lot of professional ghost hunters and ghost chasers and paranormal teams come in and spend the night there, and it never failed them to show them lots of activity. They were very pleased. They always stayed the whole night, and they left with lots of stuff.
Now, weren't you going to do haunted events there? Did you ever wind up using it as an event space?
My plan was, I was going, you know Lori Jacobson, right?
Sure.
John Provost's wife, wrote Haunted Hollywood. Okay. Lori had told me, she says, if you can prove that house is haunted and you're Eddie Munster and you're buying your grandma's old house, there's got to be a TV show in there, you know, a reality show. And the elevator pitch was Eddie Munster meets Andy of Mayberry in the Twilight Zone. Because of the house
right,
and
exactly.
Small town atmosphere.
Right, yes.
And so what happened was I bought the house to save it. I put the roof on it, did the electric, did the HVAC, and did everything I could to make it, you know, livable, which I did. Hollywood wasn't interested at all. So I was only at the house 50 days a year because of my travel. My ex-wife had trouble staying in the house because of the spirits. She wasn't comfortable there. So we kept spending nights in hotels in town. And it just got to be like, why do I own a house if I'm not staying in it? And this TV show didn't happen. So I wound up selling it to someone that was going to finish the restoration. It was more than I could handle. But I did save it from the wrecking ball, which was my main goal.
Awesome. Yes. I'm sorry that I understand not wanting to live in it. Hence, I love other people's ghosts, but I don't want them in my house. I'm the same way.
Yeah, it was just
I understand.
The small town was great. And it was fun, but it was 2.5 hours from any major airport. It was very difficult for me to conduct business that remote, that you know, that far off the beaten path. So as it turned
out,
the best
thing
happened. The house got sold. I moved on. She moved on. I'm single now. I'm back on the road doing what I love to do, and everybody's happy.
That's fantastic. And where are you living now, and do you love where you are?
I am now, I do not have an actual residence. I use my sister's address in Manhattan Beach because that's where I was for a year during the pandemic. Right now I'm in a wonderful hotel resort area, but I'm probably going to, when and if this all takes place, my probable address will be somewhere in the southeast, and Nashville seems to be a strong, seems to be in the lead as far as a potential city to live in for a while.
Right. And why is that? What draws you to it?
Nashville, a friend of mine, a gentleman named Bill Miller, and he was Johnny Cash's lifelong friend. And when Johnny Cash passed, he left Bill in charge of his estate. And Bill is a very good friend, and he moved to Nashville and opened up property after property after property after property. And we would like to work together to maybe do this movie magic theater thing and a Munster escape room scenario in one of his properties in Nashville. Yeah, to do it right
nice.
And have a residence, I have to have a tourist town.
Right, of course. Yeah, of course.
And they call
which
it, and they
which
call
the
it
house,
Nash
which
Vegas
the house
for,
you grew up in
they
really
call it
isn't.
Nash Vegas for a reason.
Right, exactly. And it's always been an industry town. Even when I was a kid, and it was much smaller and sleepier then than it is now. My mom grew up in Louisville, Kentucky, so that's only about 3 hours from Nashville, maybe four. It's not very far.
Yeah, no,
it's just right up that same freeway.
Yep.
Yeah, it's not bad at all. And so I remember going through Nashville a lot as a kid, and I love it. But even when it was tiny, when I was a kid in the 70s, it still had a very entertainment industry feel about it. And now it's even more so, right? I mean, it's kind of become like a Southern LA meets a Southern Vegas.
Yeah, that's like I just said, they call it Nash Vegas for a reason.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, it reminds me of older Vegas. Cause now Vegas reminds me of, if LA and Tokyo had a baby. Vegas has become so big now that it doesn't even, it's become so international that it's hard to remember that it's in the middle of the desert.
Well, you know, when I go to Vegas, I stay on Old Fremont Street, you know, because that's the old feel of Vegas to me.
Yeah, and I love that very much. So we were talking about the Munsters a little bit, and I was thinking, we've talked about this before when you've done my shows, but I think one of the things that appealed so much to people about the Munsters was not just the family values, which were great, but also the fact that, you know, they were outsiders, but they didn't care. They were outsiders, but they never felt like outsiders. They thought they were normal and everybody else was kind of odd, and they were always so shocked when anybody thought they were outsiders. And that was really before Hollywood gave us permission to let our freak flag fly and be different. It was before you saw a lot of diversity in television. And here was this very diverse family that just felt like they were just the average neighbors, and they were always so shocked when anybody thought they weren't, which happened like practically every week, right, on the show.
Yes, and it led to very funny script. It was done by the same people that had done Leave It to Beaver. And prior to Leave It to Beaver, they also did Amos and Andy in the 50s. So they were kind of like, you know, they were out on the ordinary shows to begin with. But Leave It to Beaver lent itself to a very youth-led cast. I mean, the show was about kids, and the parents were the secondary characters, where the Munsters was a family-friendly sitcom, but because of the nature of Universal being the Monster Studio, they utilize this concept that Bob Clampett, the animator, actually had a animated series in the late 40s and the early 50s about a family like the Munsters that never was developed. So they took that idea and resurrected it as a project, because I think they caught wind of the Addams Family was going into production, and they were looking for something to compete. And they came up with this idea that was, in my opinion, the reason it worked so well was the same script would be very normal and wouldn't be very funny, but because of the nature of anything that would happen to Herman Munster in a normal situation would be a very funny, because there would be a twist and the opposite was effect. You know, up was down, down was up, blah, blah, blah. And the fact that Herman and Grandpa had this, the Grandpa could perform magic, and you had this great old house and all the special effects and all the Universal monsters and all that at their disposal, they took something that would have been a normal show, would have been boring, and it became very funny and warm and just unique, and it worked for some reason.
I think it worked great, and I love it. And I think that we see that, you know, from my experience in the paranormal world and my experience in the horror world, going to conventions and stuff, that it's like people come to be scared, but if you look at some of the great, what we consider our most famous horror kind of shows and films, all very much about the relationship between the people. It's about the family created in the show, whether it's people that are fighting the other, and the other is the bad guy, like, you know, a la Walking Dead, or whether it's the family of people who are different, who are the other, standing together. And I think you find at these conventions, as I'm sure you have seen over and over again, Butch, this intense sense of family. And
people
really interested in what family is about.
Well, I'll tell you how, that's absolutely right. And here's a good example. As soon as you turn on the TV and the Munsters would come on, and you would see the Herman Munster character, the Frankenstein character. And as soon as Fred would speak, he was no longer Frankenstein. He was Herman Munster, and he was he was the father. He never became Frankenstein the monster ever. He was Herman Munster, family man, head of the household.
Yep.
Lily Munster, she was never Pyra. She was the matriarch who held everything together. Grandpa was never Count Dracula. He was the, you know, I mean, they transcended the monsters they were, and they became the human element immediately.
Right. And they became even a better version of it, right? Like the two of them had a wonderful marriage. The father-in-law kind of pissed everybody off, but that's kind of normal, right? Your character was going through normal kid things. Marilyn was going through abnormal, you know, teenager things, because we know she was the ugly one that didn't fit in, which always makes me laugh. And I tell you, I use that analogy all the time when I'm in a group of other psychics and they all have like a turban on and an owl on their shoulder and stars and moons, moo-moos. And I just look like I fell out of the ass of Connecticut, which I basically did. And I always laugh that I'm like the Marilyn Munster of the paranormal world because I look so normal. But for that,
well,
they sort of put up with her despite the fact that she was, you know, she was the way she was.
Well, and the beauty of that whole thing was, is if you talk about the family unit, they were she was the oddball that they were a warm enough and loving enough family to take her in, like families do.
Yes.
You know?
Exactly. Yes. And I think that that is the thing about, and that's the thing about people, right? I think we've seen that during this COVID epidemic. Sometimes human beings need an enemy. They need something to push against. And I think that's why stories where there are outsiders, specifically because we're talking about this, paranormal and horror community stories, the people band together against the threat. And on the Munsters, the threat was like kind of the bitchy neighbors, or somebody was always trying to get in the middle of their perfect family unit and sort of mucking up what they had going.
And keep this in mind, this was the 60s. There was a lot of social upheaval. There was a lot of stuff going on in the 60s.
Yes.
And,
yes.
You know, the Munsters were a family living on the block that, you know, that the neighbors were they weren't happy. They didn't get to know them. They judged them before they got to know them. So there was a lot of subtle little social overtones that were used on the Munsters that a lot of people didn't talk about back then, but they were very apropos for the time.
Oh, absolutely. I just watched have you seen the Amazon Prime series, Them? Amazing. But it's a horror series, but it's set in the 60s when an African-American family from the South moves to Compton, which was then an up-and-coming middle-class white neighborhood. And literally from the minute they drive in the station wagon, everyone's standing out in the street with their mouth hanging open, it's straight out of an episode of The Munsters. But you're right, the social commentary that was done in such a clever way. And that is so important, sweetheart. And, you know, there were people, I mean, I was one of them, watching that show as a kid and feeling like it was okay to be different because they were so cool. And I would imagine that in your work of conventions and meeting with people and traveling, you probably hear that story like practically every day of your life.
Well, you know, the book that I actually wrote came out like five or six, seven years ago now. Jeez, it came out in 2014 in conjunction with the 50th anniversary. But it was basically, it's called Munster Memories. And I came up with the idea simply because I was lucky enough to sit at a table when I would go out and meet people. And they would come to the table and they would be sharing to me, their personal stories about how important your show was to their family and to themselves and how important, and you found yourself being part of almost a family member. These people treated you like, hey, you were part of our family. You know, I wanted to be you. I wish I lived in your house. And it's like, God, that's so exciting that people are so, they're so enamored and they're so happy to have met you because you were part of a positive part of their life, whether they watched the show with their grandma or grandpa who's no longer with them or their favorite aunt or uncle. But the bottom line is this was part of you were part of their family unbeknownst to you. And here you are sharing an experience with them. And all you got to do is smile and they're happy and you take a photo with them and you've made somebody extremely happy for a minimal amount of effort on your part.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And isn't that a wonderful thing? And isn't it, a friend of mine who I've known for years, in my 20s and 30s, I was a music promoter, and a friend of mine who I'd known from booking his band since I was, you know, in my early 20s, got a regular role on the show Supernatural. And his band was playing, and they'd been on my show a bunch. And so he invited me and a friend of mine to come out and watch them play. And I was expecting it to be all people that loved monsters because, you know, Supernatural at the time, or very early in the show, was very episodic. And every week, the two of them hunted a different kind of ghost or monster. But what it was these people that loved the relationship of these two brothers that were, in essence, orphaned, and how they kind of went through life clinging to each other and battling things around them. And it was this audience of people who wanted to talk about family. It was not at all what I thought I was going to encounter. And it made me very much rethink what that community really is and how much those people love the idea of family. And that just, and also like we talked about, you know, being, you know, recognizing yourself in the outsider. And I think in the 60s, it was much easier to address those issues with a family of monsters, quote unquote, than it was to do it with a family like in Them, where an actual black family moved into the neighborhood. I think it would have been too controversial for TV. But it's so easy to get across the messages you need to get across using the guise of the paranormal and the supernatural, which I think is wonderful. I mean, even if you look at the classic Universal horror films, right? I mean, Frankenstein, so much about being different and alienation and, you know, Dracula is basically a sociopath and, you know, all the different things and what, you know, the Wolfman is like, it's like I think how a lot of teenagers feel going through puberty to the nth power. It's teenage drama to the nth power.
Yes, I mean, so, Wolfman is a sympathetic character. You know, he knows what's going to happen. He doesn't want to have happen to him what happens every full moon, but you know, he can't help it.
Yeah, and Frankenstein, right? My heart breaks for Frankenstein every single time because that poor guy didn't ask to be reanimated, and he just keeps getting it from every direction. So I think it's so important that you go out and you do this and that you bring the cars. And how many cars do you have?
Well, I've got just a Munster Coach and the Dragula and my truck and my trailers and stuff, but that's really all I have at the moment. But I've always been a gearhead, you know, growing up on the Munsters and knowing George Barris since I was a kid. And it's fun because, you know, I enjoy travel, so I do that. And, you know, I have a YouTube channel, Coach to Coast, which allows me to do a Charles Kuralt kind of stories along the way of, you know, little towns and interesting things that I see, which I really enjoy. But I found an interesting niche. I like cars. I like drag racing. The Munster cars happen to be the really cool cars on TV. And I put them all together, and I came up with a niche angle to do events. You know, instead of now, I mean, I appreciate being able to go to a show with a briefcase full of 8x10s, and it's easy, and you're in and you're out. But I do it much differently now because, you know, a trailer and a truck and a travel, and you're the first one in and the last one to leave. I have a lot more appreciation for rock bands and people that have a lot more stuff to set up, you know, the worker bees.
Absolutely, right? Yeah, and it's great. Mm-hmm. Are you amazed that you got both of those cars?
Well, they're not the originals, first of all. These are replica cars. The original Munster Coach is in a museum in Miami with $1 million price tag on it. And the original Dracula happens to be in my car club. My friends got it. But I have I'm building another Dracula right now, a very accurate one. The one that I used to have was from the movie where Fred Gwynne drove it. It didn't have a canopy on it like the one in the TV show. So I'm building an accurate TV show, and as we speak, and the Munster Coach that I have is under contract to a person who's buying it, but I'm building another Munster Coach to be accurate as well. So eventually I will have, you know, I'm really happy with my cars, but I would prefer to have them be engine accurate. Both of these are Chevys, and the originals were Fords. So I'm going back to the drawing board and making them both really, really, really special. But yeah, I mean, the Munsters is very interesting because it allows me, it falls into so many different categories that when I do go out, I mean, I've done tattoo conventions all over the world because there's so much ink on people from Universal Monsters and the Munsters. And then I've done car-related events because obviously the reasons the cars, heavily merchandise show, tons of toys from the Munsters. So I get to do collectibles and memorabilia shows. I can do horror sci-fi shows. I also could just do, you know, classic TV and comedy and 60s nostalgia. It's interesting. It's for one little 2-year show, it's amazing the scope and the width of the fan base that I can tap into. So I'm very blessed in that respect.
Yeah, it set you up with a whole life, didn't it? I mean, who would have thunk? How little were you when you started on the show?
I was 11 and 12 and 13 for the movie. And then I didn't really want to talk about the Munsters, and I quit acting when I was 21. But when MTV came on the air, what brought me back into the Munster realm was we wanted to make rock videos, and the project that we chose to do a rock video of was Whatever Happened to Eddie, which was the Munster theme with lyrics that I wrote. And we were the first unsigned act ever to be on MTV.
Wow. Wow. Why
and
do you
they
think?
And the,
I know,
they,
I know.
No, I was going to say,
go
and
on,
they started
please.
The basement tapes from that idea. They thought, well, wow, if these guys have this video and they don't have a record deal, there must be a lot of other bands that are making videos of themselves, and maybe we should look into that so maybe we can find some up-and-comers, and they formed a show called The Basement Tapes.
Wow. Wow. Why do you think, and you know I have many, many friends who are child actors of our generation.
Yes.
And I hear this story all the time. I don't know that I've ever asked this on the air. Even though, you know, our mutual friend Robbie Rist from the Brady Bunch was actually in my first band, and he was in the first lineup of my band, and he was in the house band for my first TV show. So I grew up with the idea of Rob will come, but we don't mention Brady. Now he's different, but I think every kid kind of goes through that phase. Why do you think it was that you didn't want to talk about the Munsters when you were young?
I was never very comfortable with my fame. I never spoke about it at school, lived outside the Hollywood circle, didn't attend Hollywood parties, very much wanted to be a regular kid, slot cars, little league, mini bikes, go-karts, dirt bikes. I felt I was uncomfortable in my own skin being famous, so I just chose not to talk about it.
Yeah, I understand that. Talking about isolation, right? Was it hard for you growing up? I mean, it can be kind of an isolating world for kids because other kids sort of at the same time want to be them, at the other time sometimes make fun of them. I mean, it's a hard thing to go to regular school but people know you're on a TV show, even if it's just for a couple of years.
Well, I'll give you a brief example. When I finished the Munsters, I was, first of all, small for my age, number one, which was great for Hollywood, but bad for, you know, going in up against bullies. But I entered, after the Munsters, I was in seventh grade, second semester of seventh grade. And the school that I was going to go back into was called Perry Junior High in Gardena. 3,500 students, and it was a giant school.
A lot.
And what it was 25% Asian, 25% Black, 25% White, and 25% Latino. It was a real melting pot. And
it was so
big.
Amazing.
That they had, it was so large that they had two shifts of everything. They had two lunches, two nutritions, two this, two that. So what happened was when I went into public school for the first day at nutrition, all the kids would circle around and basically they wouldn't go back to their classes on time, and there'd be 400 or 500 kids just being kids and poking, you know, I mean, asking questions and, you know, making fun of you and this and that, which is what kids do. But what hurt me the most was the vice principal of the school, Mr. Brenner. We always have his name memorized. His solution to the whole thing was to throw me out of school for causing a disturbance. So they tossed me out of school, and my mom, you either have to go back to school or you have to go to public school. And I go, to private school. And I said, I don't want to go to private school. So I went back into public school again. Same thing happened, threw me out again. So now I have a real dilemma. I either have to go back and, you know, win these people over and tell them that I'm not going to be going away anymore. And that's what I did. And they gave me one last chance. And finally, the kids, after about 2 weeks, gave up on the making fun of me. And things got sort of back to normal, but never really normal because, you know, that's kind of a traumatic experience. And kids, you know, wherever you go, they don't know you as, you know, your name. They just call you Eddie Munster, and they call my sister Eddie Munster's sister. But, you know, we got over it. My mom still lives in the same house, you know, 55 years later, so it's all good.
Right. And has your sister outgrown being called Eddie Munster's sister?
Yeah, yeah. Until she was about 16, she made fun of that. She goes, "You don't know what it's like. Until I was 15 years old, nobody knew my name."
That's fantastic. I understand. I think as kids, we just want to be normal, right? We don't want anything that makes us not normal.
Which that's kind of what led me down the path of partying, because I did something really, really well was, I had a cool car and I had access to somebody buying me beer and throwing parties. And that was my great equalizer to be one of the guys, was to bring a case of beer in the trunk of my Mach 1 and go to the gas station and work on cars all night and drink and party and smoke weed. And, you got to remember, it's 1969 and things were much different back then, and acceptable bad behavior was tolerated,
Right. When did you know, I mean, not to get all serious on you, my friend, but when did you know it was time to get sober?
Took me 41 years, partying in 69, and I stopped in 2000, I went into treatment in 2010. But I knew I was in trouble for about 5 years before I got sober.
Yeah.
It took me a while.
Yeah, it's
go ahead.
Hard. I said it's hard. I mean, I'm from a big Irish family, so lots of addicts, right? Not a surprise. And I never started because I knew if I did, there would be a problem. But, still, even though I never started, I still have an addictive personality. Don't get me near a birthday cake or Netflix or it's going to get ugly. And I've seen friends around me trying to quit. I know how hard it is. And the pressure I've received in my life to drink, especially since people know I've never had a drink in my life, and that's the truth. I mean, people will spend hours and hours and hours trying to convince me. And people will say things like, "Oh, you've never drank, but you'll drink with me." And it's like becomes an obsession for some people. So we really do in our society, right? There is a lot of pressure to drink and be like everybody else. And if you're then there's, it's hard. Uh-huh.
I'll tell you a quick funny story. In 1969, very big year in my life. First girlfriend, real physical girlfriend in April, May of the year. I get my license August 2nd. Landing on the moon, right before that. Charles Manson, I'm dating a girl in Laurel Canyon. Charles Manson's running around doing his thing, horrible thing. Just 1969 was a crazy ass year. So I drive a friend to an interview for a movie. And while I'm in the waiting room, the producer comes out and spots me, and I walk in and read for the part that I took my friend up on and get it. And 3 days later, I'm in Brazil for 3 months, no teacher, no parent. All I have to do is show up for work and do my job. And as my sister said at my one-year trip, she goes, he left as Richie Cunningham, and in 3 months he came back as John Lennon. And that was how I started off my party days, was in a huge way. I went to Brazil and I came back a whole different person.
Yeah. And do you think it was just being out on your own without supervision? Or do you think, can we actually blame Brazil?
Well, no, in Brazil, basically I found a cab driver that sold me weed, and you could go drink anything you wanted. And there was the red light district, and there was a French camera crew going down there every night. And first I looked about 14. I was just 16, just to turn 16. And in 3 months I came back, ready to continue the party on ways, and, looking like Robert Plant with my hair, down to my waist. And I had a chance at doing lots of good things, but when you want to smoke a joint before you go into an interview, the chances of success are diminished immensely.
Oh, of course. What did you, so the first year you got sober, which was, right around the time we met. See, I'm such a sober person that I turn people sober. They get sober when they meet me. What did you realize that you had missed from life? Like, what did you love right away about being sober?
Well, the when I do my speaker meetings and they ask me, what's the biggest difference, the two things number one, you're just the overall not feeling like crap all the time is a lot. It is really helpful. But the bottom line is I tell people the one biggest difference you're going to have is I would know exactly how my day was going to be when I was drinking and using. And I was going to wake up with a hangover with no money. And I was going to start looking through ashtrays and looking through on the floor for any kind of drug that you were doing the night before to see if there's any remnants left. and then you're going to get up, and then you're going to try to find some more, and you're going to have to figure out a way to make some money or to hawk something or to sell something or whatever. That's going to be your existence for the day. That's what you're going to do, and it's guaranteed. At least when you're sober, you wake up with money in your pocket, you don't have a hangover, and you don't know what the day is about to bring you. It's going to be a surprise. It's going to be a wonderful sober day, and it's going to be great, and it's going to be an adventure. It's not going to be torture, and it's not going to be ugly, and that's the biggest difference.
Yeah, that's wonderful, and that's truly wonderful. I remember having never used, but my boyfriend after in my early 20s was a recovered addict, and we were – I think it was like my 30th birthday party. It was four or five couples, like all my best friends. And one day he and my best friend's boyfriend, now husband, started having this conversation about the 80s because they were both, one a bass player and one a guitar player. And then the conversation suddenly turned to, I think we ever talked about this on the air before, the conversation suddenly turned to, did you ever wake up and realize that you were out of drugs and start fishing through the shag carpet looking for something that had fallen? And they're
right.
Describing
Absolutely.
This in great detail. And the rest of the crowd was really not druggers. And everyone's kind of looking at them like, what is going on? And they're telling the story and cracking each other up because apparently that was a normal thing when you were doing coke or meth or anything, that you'd wake up in the morning and go, oh, holy hell, I'm out. And then think, well, maybe something dropped in the carpet. And you would literally wander around the shag carpet looking to see what you could find. And I thought that was such an interesting story because being somebody who never did anything, I was like, wow, that never even ever would have thought that could happen to me. But isn't it funny how the different experiences that we have in our lives, depending on the decisions that we make?
Yeah, you know, it's funny too because I used to smoke cigarettes back in the early 80s. And New Year's Day one day, I woke up New Year's morning, hungover, no money, no cigarettes, and I found myself looking through the ashtrays for cigarette butts, and I looked up in the mirror and I saw myself, and I never smoked a cigarette again after that day. Cold turkey over 35-40 years now. But that's amazing what a visual image of negative nature can do to you if it's strong enough. And then what helped me with sobriety was I knew that I had heard people saying that cigarettes was harder to give up for some people than heroin and other things, and I said, well, I cold turkey cigarettes and I know I have the strength in me. And then once I got the education and treatment about why I was doing what I was doing, I was able to take direction, which came back from being the movies, took direction, listened to those that knew more than I did, took their advice, and did what I was told, and the rest was is history, so to speak.
That's beautiful. And it does feel good. I mean, it's hard to go through life sober, but in essence, it feels good, right? Because there's many wonderful experiences. And it feels good to really experience those things. And I don't think you could have kept the schedule that you're keeping now had you not been sober.
No.
Because you keep a crazy schedule, Butch.
I probably wouldn't be on this show right now because I would have taken your option that you gave me earlier today that said you want me to reschedule. I would have said yes, and I don't do that anymore. I have not missed one appointment since I've been sober, and I'm very proud of that. And
good
I'm
for you.
Maintain that. Because it's the right thing to do, and one thing when you're sober, you commit to something. Now, there have been some things that have slipped my mind that I've been caught, oh, my God, I forgot to put on my notepad, but it's never been an intentional situation. And now what I try to do is I tell people, please text me the day before in case I forget and remind me, like you did, and I put it in my phone and my reminders, and it's a good system. But, yes, it would be difficult to do what I do, especially – dragging a 34-foot trailer around, and I wouldn't do what I do if I was drinking. I just wouldn't do it. It wouldn't be possible, and it wouldn't be safe.
Yeah, that's like an accident waiting to happen, and nobody wants to get mowed over by the Monstermobile.
It's hard to pretend
it's not you when that's what happens, Butch. You can't really say it wasn't me.
I have a very strange way of looking at stuff. When I used to use, I could justify me using any time, any day, 7 days a week, I could come up with a justification that in my mind would allow me the rationale to do what I was doing. I was horrible at it. I mean, I was really good at it, but it was horrible. And if I had the same situation now, I would be able to rationalize up, oh, this or that. Or this, you know, I would always be able to come up with a reason for doing something. And now my rationalization is, hey, I partied for 41 years. I have had more than enough drugs, cracks. I've never stuck a needle in my arm. The one thing I would never do. So I never did heroin. I never did any kind of, you know, intravenous stuff. But I have had enough parties, beer, you name it, I've done it, that more than 10 times over. So I'm fine. I've done what I needed to do, and I survived it. I never killed anybody. I never hurt anybody, and other than just, you know, myself and my family. But now I'm good with it, going to my grave sober, because I had a 41-year window of partying. Plenty.
Yeah, that's kind of how I feel about losing weight. Like, I ate every Snickers bar on earth, and I've had every flavor. I've had all 31 flavors. Now I can go on in my life and be a little healthier.
It's strange how we rationalize stuff, but it works.
Isn't it? But whatever works, works, my friend. So tell me when your events are, because believe it or not, we're almost out of time. And I don't want to keep you late, because I know you've got even more things to do tonight. So when can people come out and see you, and when are these events happening, and where?
The best thing to do is look at Munsters.com, my website. Everything is there, from my schedule to the store to merchandise, blah, blah, blah. No commercials required. But from there, you can get to the fan group. You can get to my schedule. Munsters.com is the best way. Yeah, I have Facebook, and yeah, I have Twitter and Instagram, but I don't really use them much, to be honest with you. Facebook is about all I can handle, but the website is updated daily, and that's the best way to do it. And I am going to be, like I say, I will be at the Dale Starbird's Hot Rod Show in Tulsa this weekend, and then I'll be in Cincinnati at a collectible store in a mall. I don't have the name of it in front of me. You'll have to go to the website. And then I've just booked two Days of the Dead dates, one in Indianapolis, which will be in July, the middle of July, and then one in November in Chicago. And then in between, I've got a Paracon the last week of August up in northern Michigan, and a bunch of other stuff thrown in all over the place. But the theaters thing, the Munsters and Merlin Spooktacular Night of Magic and Movies, that's going to be the one that's going to start logging up on the calendar real soon. So that would be the one that people want to see. They'll want to come out and have a great evening. That is highly recommended.
Fantastic. I'm so excited to get involved. You've got one coming up in L.A., right?
L.A., my plan is to start in the southeast, work my way to the northeast, hit the Midwest, and be out in California by October.
Wonderful. I love it. I can't wait to see you when you're here. And one more time, my friend, where can people see you online? When can people find you online real quick?
Munsters.com, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
Wonderful. Thank you for being here, my friend. It is always such an honor to have you here with me. And, you know, I think you're a fantastic guy and a super talent. And I can't wait to see you again soon. And please come back and visit all my shows, and we will have more fun. I would love that. Everybody, my wonderful friend, Butch Patrick, he's terrific. What an honor to have him here.
Can I say one last thing?
Please.
Okay, I forgot. One of your dear friends, Gretchen Bonaducci, is throwing a birthday party for her.
Oh, my goodness. We lost him right in the middle of that. Gretchen is doing a birthday. Maybe he'll call back. SheenaMetalSpiritual.com. HauntedPlayground.com, LiveParanormal.com. I am available for private sessions, readings, and healings, and all kinds of things. Would love to have you call me, and we'll do some good work together. That would be awesome. And check out everything you need at SheenaMetalSpiritual.com. Till I see you next time, please stay spooky. Seek peace, live in love, lead with kindness. Think about unity and community, two of my favorite words. Thank you to Live Paranormal for having me. Let's do this again soon. Find me tonight, 9 o'clock Pacific time. It's Haunted Playground After Dark on the Live Paranormal video channel, facebook.com/TheLiveParanormal. I love you all, and I'll see you next week. Every Wednesday at 6 o'clock, we're here. It's Haunted Playground, and I'm Sheena Metal.